Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock right now on this day back in history in 1899. That's where we start the history lesson on the 10th of December 1899, the start of the week known as Black Week in British history would begin this week. It was, of course, the time in which the British army suffered three devastating defeats at the hands of the Boer Republics in the Second Boer War. So not a very good time in British history for that. In 1901, we kind of kicked off a lot of Nobel Prize winners, and this would run throughout history, with the first in 1901 being the first Nobel Prize in physics being awarded to a Wilhelm Röntgen, who was the founder of X-rays. We would also then go on to see various Nobel Prizes being awarded. 1906, Theodore Roosevelt would be the first American to win the Nobel Peace Prize. 1964, Dr. Martin Luther King would win a Peace Prize in Norway. 1984, the late Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu would win his Nobel Peace Prize. In 1994, the leaders instrumental in the peace negotiations in the Middle East, both on the Palestinian and Israeli side, Yasser Arafat and Shimon Peres, amongst others, awarded Nobel Peace Prizes there. 2009 would be Barack Obama's Peace Prize. So a litany of Nobel Prizes being awarded on this day in history. In 1926, though, on this day, part two of Mein Kampf would be published. For those who don't know, that is the memoir that was written by Hitler. And in 2012, on this particular day, Google would start selling laptops at $99. I'd want a $99 laptop. That's certainly an affordable laptop. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at trusts. We're going to speak to the South African Revenue Services, and in particular, the trust division of the South African Revenue Services, in just understanding how SARS sees trusts, how they tax trusts, and all the things you need to know from a SARS perspective, at least, about trusts. I suppose this is going to be the first of many conversations around that. And then we've got a conversation with the Black Business Council around their views on McKinsey & Company. For those that don't know, McKinsey & Company settled last week with U.S. authorities and the NPA, agreeing to pay $122 million, or about 1.2 billion rand, for things related to state capture and corruption and other settlement matters in that regard. The Black Business Council feels that more should be done to hold companies accountable. We're going to get a sense from them around what they mean by that when we speak to the Black Business Council CEO, Hanki Matabane, later on in the show. Then we've got a conversation with the head of deals and origination at the JSE on the latest introduction to the JSE's bourse by a UK listed REIT, real estate investment trust company listed in the UK on the FTSE exchange as its primary listing, is now seeking a secondary listing in South Africa. And we're going to look at that and why South Africa is becoming an attractive place for listings. Interestingly enough, the REIT in question owns Tesco's. Anyone that's been to the UK would know that this REIT is responsible for a lot of the Tesco's that are set up on that side of the world. And then we're going to wrap things up with our favorite property feature of the year. We're going to start reflecting on the year that was. We're going to do this over this week and next week just to unwind and just remember some of the big stories that came out throughout the year.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we start off the show with how the markets have been moving throughout the day. It's been opposite day of movements from what it was yesterday, but I suppose there's been a couple of developments regardless, and we're going to look at those developments with the wealth manager from PSG Wealth, Nellis Brink. He joins me now on the line to take a look at some of the movements throughout the day. Good evening, Nellis. Lovely to catch up with you as always. Quieter day in some respects, depending on which markets you were looking at, but not necessarily a positive day. We started off the week quite strong. Today was a red day.
Good evening, Jimmy. Good to be back. Yes, definitely. We can see South Africa's slowing down. We love our December holidays, so we see a slowdown in trade. We see a bit of a softer market. I mean, we had a cracker of a month. For the 1 month, we're up more than 3%, and year to date, we're touching on 14%. So really good year. For the day, we're down around about 40 basis points. That's negligible. That's in our world a flat day. But as you mentioned, that depends on what industry you're in. If you're in mining, mining never sleeps, and they seem to keep on cracking it.
You bring up mining, Nellis, and we got some mining production numbers come through today as well. Obviously, a lot to do with just what's happening at the moment. Production updates, China, we'll get to China in a moment, but from a mining production perspective, South Africa is such a big mining country. We've been on the receiving end of a lot of negative global sentiment that's affected the miners because, from a demand side, we haven't really seen that China demand return to the market as people thought. What's the production update looking like? Like, are miners still hanging in there?
It seems like it's definitely turning around if we look at two things at the same time. Firstly, our production update. So our September update was revised upwards from 4.7% to 4.9%. And just remember, there was an expectation or a forecast of 3%. So a massive upside surprise in September. And then the figures that you're referring to that came out today, another 1.4% in the positive. And then more specifically on company level, Thungela Resources expect coal production to exceed targets in December 2024. And then we've also seen some improved rail logistics, which would further help on coal production.
Nellis, let's look at the, well, while we're on the coal production, I suppose let's look at Thungela, because I saw there was an update from Thungela, and then we'll move to international matters. What was Thungela's update?
So their update would be then, and as I quickly mentioned, their coal production will exceed their targets, and remember, their targets already exceed forecast. So the coal miners are really cracking it, and then of course that must link to exports and the increased demand in China.
How will that demand in China influence markets globally? I mean, globally, everything's kind of grinded to a halt. China's been underperforming by their standards, which, I mean, is really saying something
It's
considering
very high.
we set the bar so high for China, but they've been underperforming. What does that mean for global markets going into 2025? It's going to be one of those years where we finally seem to have a handle on interest rates. Maybe inflation goes up a bit, maybe interest rates don't get cut as quickly. But how are prospects looking for the new year?
So, firstly, China, I think they surprised us quite a bit. With their trade surplus expanding to 97.44 billion. And just remember, the expectation was around about 95. So this is still a massive country and a massive player when it comes to trade. Now, that being said, we've seen Trump reacting very negatively to them, and he would focus his trade tariffs on China. But remember, the US isn't the only country out there. So I think China is coming back, and as you say, their standards are very high. We all panic if they grow below 7%, which is which is a brilliant figure for any other country out there. And their increased growth would, of course, mean an increase in exports for us. So that's a very good thing. You mentioned inflation. So inflation figures coming up. We're seeing our own inflation rate coming up tomorrow, and then the US on Thursday. No, US is tomorrow as well. So our own inflation rate expected is around about 3%. So that's slightly higher than the last month, but 3% still way on the lower end of our target. And then, of course, the US inflation, we don't really expect any surprises. We expect it to come out at about 2.7, which is technically above their target line of 2. I think we can expect rate cuts to keep continuing at the pace where we're going.
It sounds very positive. It sounds rather optimistic from that perspective. I think what would be even better would be if South Africa would grow at 7% a year, but we'll get there one of these days, right? Nellis, I want to take a look
Perhaps we should
at.
hire McKinsey to tell us how to do
Oh, I don't
that.
know. That might be an awkward conversation. We'll circle back to that one. I want to look at the Rand. The Rand finishing off the year a lot stronger. I mean, last week we were above 18 Rand. We were 18.10, 18.15 at one stage. This week came out, opened below 18 Rand, 17.75, holding currently at about 17.86 or so. The Rand clearly showing at last gasp wanting to end the year off stronger. And that's not just against the dollar. I mean, that's against every major currency.
I think the main reason for that is our Reserve Bank not blindly following the Federal Reserve. Governor Kanyahu has shown great strength and great responsibility. And I know he's been lambasted in the media for not cutting as quickly, because obviously there's a lot of pressure on the consumer. But if you clearly look at the Reserve Bank report, he said, and his team said, we need to revise our inflation target downwards. We are not a small developing African country anymore. So we can't be sitting with an inflationary target of 6. And the only way we can phase into that is by cutting rates slower than the leading economy. And he's been doing that, and that massively strengthens the Rand. And like I said, yes, to great pressure on our consumer. But I think for the slightly longer term picture, it's the responsible play.
Nellis, you and I are going to have a conversation about how South Africa is no longer a developing country. That's a story for another day. Before I let you go, I want to take a look at OPEC. They met today. What did they have to say? Are we going to have softer oil prices? Are we going to see fuel cuts in future? What's happening?
So we haven't seen the full update of the meeting just yet, but just before the meeting, they were planning on delaying the December output hike because there is a soft oil demand currently. It is a little bit slower. It is, of course, due to wars slowing down slightly, production slowing down slightly. Remember, in the Northern Hemisphere, we're entering winter. So I think they will delay the cut or the increase in output hike, which obviously cut prices, for just a little bit. I'm very, very excited to see what comes from that meeting. I'm sure we'll have the notes on it soon.
We will hope that we get the relevant cuts. Obviously, the oil price is something that the OPEC bloc is going to keep a very close eye on going into the new year and wrapping up this year. But I think we'll wrap the conversation up there, Nellis. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. As always, lovely catching up with you. Nellis Brink, Wealth Manager at PSG Wealth, joining me to take a look at some of the market movements throughout the day, as well as what could potentially be on investor minds at the moment.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Retirement has been top of mind for investors this year, with the introduction of the two-pot system sparking many complex questions and conversations. Tune into the SAFM Market Update tomorrow evening at 6:45 as Richard Carter, Head of Assurance at Allan Gray, joins me to highlight the key considerations investors should think about when it comes to their retirement as they look ahead. Brought to you by Allan Gray. More than 50 years of long-term investment. Allan Gray is an authorized financial services provider.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So yesterday we were taking a look at the different kinds of structures that you might find from an offshore perspective if you're coming back into the country and what you need to remember around those things. And today I thought we'd take a look at things from a different perspective. We're going to be taking a look at trusts and particularly the tax side of things where it relates to trust. There have been a lot of changes that have come through by way of things like us being greylisted and the introduction of things like the Ultimate Beneficial Ownership Registry. And I thought we'd take a look at how this affects the trust environment and what you need to know where it relates to the South African Revenue Services. With that in mind, I'm joined on the line by a trust specialist within the trust product segment at the South African Revenue Services, Lana Pinkham, to take a look at this and see if we can get our heads around it. Good evening, Lana. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start by understanding a trust in the eyes of SARS. How does SARS see trusts, and how is it different from, say, an individual taxpayer, a company taxpayer? What are some of the differences there?
Good evening, Jimmy. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Indeed, a very important question. SARS sees a trust as a very important entity. It's seen as a person, not a natural person, but it is a person, and it places a lot of emphasis on trust because they are used to move money around. So there's, especially now with the grey listing, more focus on trust than ever before.
Lana, when we look at trust, there's obviously different types of vehicles and structures and setups and how people actually put trusts together. Is there a difference between a local trust and an offshore trust? I mean, we understand, of course, that from an offshore perspective, individuals are often taxed on worldwide income. And I wonder, from a trust perspective, does SARS recognize an offshore trust?
SARS definitely recognize an offshore trust. Depends whether they've got a source income in South Africa. If I've got a source income in South Africa, they must register for tax in South Africa. So a South African trust is a resident in South Africa, and they, all trusts have to be registered for income tax in South Africa.
Lana, what about the beneficiaries? What if the trust sits outside of South Africa, but the beneficiaries sit inside South Africa?
That's also a very good question. Since the beneficiaries is inside South Africa, they are residents and they must pay tax on any amounts they receive.
Receive from the trust, that is?
Yes, that because this, they receive, they are taxed on their worldwide income, so they will be taxed on the income they receive.
Right. So in that case, the offshore trust might be considered an offshore entity, but the individuals benefiting from that trust are considered to be local taxpayers. That makes sense. Lana, speaking of beneficiaries, there was an introduction of the Ultimate Beneficial Owners Registry, and that was obviously as a result of the grey listing that South Africa was placed on by the Financial Action Task Force. This was one of the measures kind of put in place, not just from a trust perspective, but from a company and an individual perspective, just to provide more transparency and clarity around companies in particular and the ownership of companies. Where it relates to trusts, how does that look? How is that different from, say, a private company where it comes to the beneficial ownership registry?
Also a good question. Thank you very much. The beneficial owners are the warm bodies behind the trust. And that can be the trustees, the beneficiaries, the donors, the protectors, or the founders. And it's actually the person that ultimately benefit from the proceeds of a trust or the income of a trust or the capital of a trust, irrespective of whether it's capital or income, it's the persons that ultimately benefit from these proceeds.
Lana, now that we've got the understanding out the way of the different kinds of trusts and the setups and all of that, I want to look at the activities of the trust. What if I had a trust from many years ago, or I'm part of a family trust that has been ongoing for a long period of time? Does that trust get treated differently? And are we in the realm, or can we dip into the realm of active versus passive trusts and how trusts actually function? How do you guys see it from a SARS perspective?
Okay, if you have a trust from, say, 20 years back and it has not yet registered at SARS, we recommend you register as soon as possible, for the filing season that ends on the 20th of January, and make sure you submit accurate tax returns and pay the correct amount of tax. In the public notice every year, it indicates the due dates to submit tax returns, and you specifically ask when is a trust passive, when we see a trust passive or active. We don't usually use the word dormant trust. We use passive and active trusts. A passive trust are the trusts that's actually got no transactions during the year, and they might have assets, but they haven't traded during the year and they are inactive. We are active trust or the rest of the trusts, and all trusts, irrespective whether they're passive or active, must submit tax returns. There's a shorter version of an ITR 12T tax return. When you complete the wizard, you can request a passive trust, and then, or you indicate you've got a passive trust, and then you will submit a shortened version of a trust return.
Lana, speaking of the tax side of it, lots in the past we've known that trusts are taxed at a slightly different tax rate. I mean, we know the corporate tax rate, we know that the individuals are taxed on a marginal sliding scale, and there's a whole tax table for that. How are trusts taxed in the eyes of SARS, and is it different for, say, older trusts, newer trusts, active trusts, passive trusts? What is the tax rate related to trusts?
Okay, the tax rate is 45%. And the except if it's a special trust, then different rates according to the gliding scale might be applicable. But in general, it's 45%. But very important, because of a conduit pipe principle, it is possible that vestings will be taxed in the beneficiary's hands. And then, for example, if a beneficiary is an individual, then they will be taxed on individual scales.
Lana, you mentioned the assets and the activities of the trust. I want to go back to that for a quick second. You mentioned that a trust sure. can hold assets, but if it hasn't transacted, then it might be considered passive. When we look at the word transact in this context, are we referring to the trusts or the trustees actively going out and entering into economic transactions, or are we talking about things like dividends? What do you define as a trust having transacted?
Okay, let me give you an example. If it's, for example, a holiday home, and the family goes once a year to the holiday home or twice a year, they don't rent out the property, they don't have any income or expenses, then it will be a passive trust. But if there's any transaction, even one transaction, that will be seen as an active trust, and then they must complete the full tax return. So an active trust, if there's any operations, any activities, and all trusts on that point must have a bank account according to the Trust Property Control Act. So a passive trust, if you look at that side, it should be like a trust that's only got bank charges. There's no activity going on in the bank account. Then they can submit a limited tax return.
Lana, what about new trusts? We've kind of touched on the old trusts and having those trusts in place. What if someone is out there thinking, I want to set up a trust and I want mm-hmm. to have the most efficient kind of tax structure between whether it's my business, my personal capacity, the trust, all of that. Obviously, sitting down with a tax practitioner is the first step in that respect. Can I register a trust, or must it be registered via the tax practitioner?
Okay, to register a trust, according to the standard operating procedures of such, the main trustees appointed by the trust will be responsible to register for income tax at SARS. And you can do that by either going to a branch or on the trust website. You have to take with, if you go to a branch, all the required documents. And on the SARS website, there's a SARS online querying system that's requesting specific documents, and that's where you register. So in general, it's the main trustee that's appointed by the trust that SARS, in the standard operating procedures, requires to register the trust.
That trustee, Lana, from a obligation perspective, especially from a compliance perspective, when we look at things like annual returns that you mentioned, and we look at things like filing season coming around, the responsibilities that sit with that trustee, is it the trust's responsibility to submit its returns and all of that? Or is there a liability that is jointly placed on a trustee to say that this is your trust, you must make sure that you submit the taxes related to it?
Very important question. The trustees are the trust representative taxpayer. And that means that each trustee is jointly liable in their personal capacity for the trust, for the tax compliance or the non-compliance of a trust, even if they are using an advisor or a tax practitioner. And often family members are appointed as trustees. So they should take note how important it is if they are the trustees, that they're also the representative taxpayers, and they need to ensure that the trust comply with all the requirements from SARS. And if it's a bit overwhelming, we recommend they should obtain the services of a tax practitioner.
There you have it, folks. Speak to a tax practitioner about all of your trust-related queries. But hopefully this gives you a bit more insight around how the South African Revenue Services views trusts and how they treat trusts from a tax perspective. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Lana. Thank you so much for the time and for the insights. That's Lana Pinkham, who is a trust specialist in the trust product segment at the South African Revenue Services, joining us to provide a bit more color around the trusts and how SARS sees them.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So last week, there were reports that McKinsey and Company had finally reached a settlement agreement with the US authorities as well as the National Prosecuting Authority in South Africa, in which McKinsey had agreed to pay $122 million, or about 1.2 billion rand, for the accusations that were leveled against it related to its past activities relating to one of its directors. Following this, of course, there have been a couple of announcements that have come out, and the Black Business Council is of the view that a company like McKinsey should no longer be allowed to do business in South Africa, perhaps, or should face more serious consequences than just a fine. I'm joined on the line by the Black Business Council's CEO, Hanky Matabane, to take a look at this and get a better understanding of it. Ntata Matabane, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your initial thoughts on the situation that McKinsey and Company find themselves in, having reached a settlement in both South Africa and in the US?
Good evening to you, Jimmy, and the listeners. The issue for us is we always need to be careful on what example are we setting and how do you treat Company A as compared to Company B. For us, I think that is very, very important. But we welcome the outcomes. And by paying the money, they are basically saying they are accepting that they are wrong. They are accepting that they are corrupt. So if someone is corrupt or if a company is corrupt, then what do? You have to hold them accountable and not only accept the money. Because if you accept the money only and then leave them, and leaving them, I mean, you leave the company, they're still doing business as if nothing has happened. You leave the executives who took the decisions and who signed off the agreements. You are sending a very, very, very wrong message, especially in South Africa, where we've got a history like we have. And we've seen other companies, for example, like Ngongi, that were fingered in the state capture, closing down, and then people are going to start asking themselves questions. Is Ngongi shutting down because it's black, and McKinsey because it's white owned, it's allowed to continue doing business? You are also making people to ask other questions, like, it looks like when you've got money in South Africa, you can buy your own freedom. Hence, we are saying we need to be very, very, very consistent in how we treat people who are found to be corrupt, because we need to set an example. We need to set a deterrent mechanism. But if this is how we're going to continue, we're going to basically find that the rich companies, they will do as they wish when they are found. Because remember, McKinsey didn't find itself, didn't reveal itself. It was discovered. When they're discovered, then they say, I'll give you the money back. And then life goes on.
Ntata Matabane, what more repercussions would you like to see as the Black Business Council? I mean, understanding, of course, McKinsey has already confirmed that the partner in question that was involved with these activities that were less than forthcoming on the corruption activities, that partner has since been fired by McKinsey from their perspective. So they've taken steps not only to pay back the money, but also to fire the partner that was implicated. What more would you want to see happen here?
Yeah, but I think that is a cop-out. That's not the issue.
Mm.
The partner does not sign for themselves. There's a process of authorization in any company. The transaction will start from someone, it goes to the next person, the third person, fourth person, fifth. And McKinsey is big, so probably maybe 5 to 10 people are involved. And nothing happens to those people. That's one. Secondly, the company itself, You accept that as a company we've corrupted South Africa, you nearly collapsed the entire country, and then you wake up tomorrow, I've paid my money, then life must go on. It must be very nice to be white and big, because the company must face consequences beside the money that they paid. Hence, we are saying they must be completely banned. They must be banned probably for 10 years, and then after 10 years, they can come. But they can't operate as if nothing has happened. Hence, we are very, very disappointed with BUSA or Business Unity South Africa for working with McKinsey, even if they claim it's pro bono. The fact that of the matter that they are busy promoting McKinsey is going to be able to get lines through them. So indirectly, they are funding state capital, because the money that McKinsey is going to get through their exposure is basically part of the money that they are paying back to South Africa. So they are basically funding state capital. And these are the people who are forever lecturing government and lecturing all of us that now corporate governance is important. Good corporate governance is important. But now they are treated, because this is part of them, they are treating them with kids' love. It's very, very disappointing. So we're calling for the total ban by both private sector and public sector, so that we set a good example and deter the others who are thinking of doing the same thing.
Mm. You bring up the BUSA announcement recently, of course, McKinsey announcing that they will be partnering with Business Unity South Africa for promoting South Africa and promoting South Africa's G20 objectives in particular, while we hold the G20 presidency. From McKinsey's perspective, they've said that it shows their commitment towards wanting to regain the trust of South Africans and their commitment towards the people of South Africa. Should we not give them the opportunity to right their wrongs? Is there another way we should be giving them an opportunity to right their wrongs? I hear you on the accountability part of it. We definitely need to be holding individuals and companies accountable for their wrongdoings. How do you respond to them saying they want to regain the trust of South Africans?
They can go for 10 years and then they can come back after 10 years and want to ask for apologies.
Mm.
There's never been a black company that was found wanting that is still existing. So hence I'm saying these things are raising racial issues, that to say if you've got a certain skin, you can do as you wish. And if you are black and small, you close down. And then McKinsey is not the only example. KPMG has been there. It's not closed down. But Ngongi, which was an accounting firm owned by blacks, closed down. So let's not perpetuate the pre-1994 behavior of saying if you are white, you can do as you wish, and then nothing happens to you. And if you are black, then you die.
Mm.
You need to create an environment where justice is seen to be done, and is done, and without any fear or favor.
Mm.
Because perception is very, very important.
Mm. And Dr. Matabane, without getting too much into the racial side of it, do you think that a part of the way things have turned out is something else that you mentioned earlier in our chat around the capital? Having the ability or the financial means to be able to settle these kinds of agreements, knowing that there might not be anything beyond that kind of settlement. Do you think that perhaps we should have something, regardless of whether it's a white-owned company, a black-owned company, from a repercussions perspective and a consequence perspective, do you think that we should have something like you mentioned, those bans being imposed, saying we understand that you have the money to repay, but we're imposing a ban so that this is the deterrent. So rather than focus on the ownership of the company and the racial side of it, should we not just be looking at it and saying, you've done wrong, there's a ban, regardless of what your business is willing to pay?
Yeah, I agree with you. That's what we must do. But remember, South Africa comes from a certain history where you're going to find that it's only white companies that can afford that money, because majority of them benefited during apartheid, they're still benefiting now. Majority of black companies are small. Even if they are small, they are medium, they cannot afford to pay those billions without disappearing. So I hear what you're saying, but you cannot ignore the history of South Africa. But even if we did not have the same history that we had, from a principal point of view, if you are found guilty, you should not be allowed to pay yourself out of your troubles.
Mm.
Because it means only those who have are favored by our law enforcement environment. Then you are creating a problem, because then the rich will continue to behave the way they want, knowing that, no, if I'm found, I'm going to buy myself out of this thing.
Corruption is corruption and it should be dealt with decisively. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Ntata Matabane. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Hanky Matabane, CEO of the Black Business Council, sharing his thoughts around the McKinsey settlement that came through last week, and perhaps more should be required of companies that have been found to have previously done wrong.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Just a slight correction on that McKinsey story, and I do apologize for this. It wasn't 1.2 billion rand. It was about 2.1 billion rand, that 122 million rand settlement agreement there. But we move on to the latest developments from the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. It looks as though we might be getting a new listing in South Africa come this week. There's a UK real estate investment trust that is looking to obtain a secondary listing in South Africa on the JSE. I'm joined on the line by the head of origination and deals at the JSE, Sam Mokorosi, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Good evening, Sam. Lovely to catch up with you as always. Let's start by taking a look at the latest developments. I mean, this is quite a historic moment, but it's not the first of its kind. We've been seeing this kind of secondary listing market pick up a bit of steam in the last couple of weeks and months.
Good evening, Jimmy. Yes, we are super thrilled to be welcoming Supermarket Income REIT from the UK for an inward listing. This is a third in about a year that we've had inward listings of UK REITs onto the JSE. We had Primary Healthcare Properties up around November last year, a month ago, a few weeks ago, actually, we had Assura, which is also a prime a healthcare property REIT. And now we're really thrilled to welcome Supermarket Income REIT onto the JSE through a secondary listing onto the bourse.
Sam, what does this mean for the South African investment space? I mean, without a doubt, it speaks to a confidence element, not just in the South African markets, but also especially in the JSE. I mean, I've spoken separately to Dr. Faree and to the rest of the JSE team around the fact that we are, of course, the biggest exchange on the continent, but we're also not sitting idly and saying, just because we're the biggest, we're not doing anything. This shows a very clear confidence from the investment community that the JSE is the exchange to go and partner with.
100%. I mean, the market cap of the companies on the JSE is close to 20 trillion rand, over $1 trillion. And so we are excited to see companies choose the JSE as a place to raise capital, as a place to trade their shares, as a place to engage with investors about their future and take investors along for the ride.
Mm. Sam, when looking at the JSE and looking at other partnerships, I mean, I think back to the announcement of things like the Saudi partnership and all the other advancements in technology from the JSE to better improve the services that we render. What is this latest announcement from something like the Supermarket Group and all the other secondary listings? What does that do for local investors? How do these inflows benefit local investors?
100%. Any investor will tell you that one of the successes of a strong portfolio is diversification. And that talks to diversification in terms of the number of shares that you're holding, but also in terms of the industries and the geographic exposure that your portfolio has. And so these inward listings from the UK allow South African investors to tap into a market that is perhaps uncorrelated to the rest of their portfolio, being UK-based properties. And so the ability to earn returns in hard currency is an attractive one for investors looking to diversify their portfolio.
Especially when you think about removing all of the headache that's involved with moving funds offshore and all of those other things that come with international transfers. Sam, I want to look at the JSE's role going forward. I mean, obviously, we've spoken about this and you and I have spoken about this in offline conversations to say that the JSE's always been open to expanding and offering opportunities, not only to local companies, but also to international companies wanting to come into to South Africa. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing that 2025 is going to be the year where we see a lot more interest return? I mean, albeit we are still battling things like grey listing that have the potential to affect how our markets are being perceived. But it does sound like we're on the right track to being a lot more positive.
100%. I think the mood in the market, certainly in the second half of this year, has been very positive. Look, you know, one thing markets don't like is volatility. So these kind of big spikes in activity, markets prefer much more kind of predictable increase over time. And so that's what we're hoping for in terms of new listings. Certainly, we've seen it in the activity in the secondary market, good flows coming in. And so we're hopeful that 2024 has been a great year for new listings. We're expecting that 2025 will be just as good, if not better. There's a whole host of companies that have publicly announced intentions to list. We're not sure whether it's going to be next year or in the next few years, but large companies like Coca-Cola South Africa, Coca-Cola Bottling Africa, ADT Fidelity Security, we've heard from African Bank as well as Time Bank that all of these are looking to join the bourse. So we are ready with open arms to welcome them when they are ready, in terms of their own financial situation, ready to list on the market.
Mm. Sam, in terms of the international companies, the likes of the Supermarkets Group and the other listings that we've seen come to South Africa, does this kind of give us any indication around potentially getting more international companies to come into South Africa? I mean, we've seen the likes of the Grand Parades that used to have Baskin Robbins and Dunkin' Donuts bring those brands into South Africa. Mm, and when we look at a REIT like this that has companies like Tesco's under it, is this a conversation that the JSE is starting to perhaps think about to say, yeah, you can come list here, but alongside that, maybe come open up some shops here, maybe come invest in the SA market as well?
Those are definitely conversations that we have. I know this particular company, the Supermarket Income REIT, is a landlord of properties that then are rented out to the likes of Sainsbury's and Tesco's and other supermarkets across Europe. So they wouldn't be the decision makers for whether Tesco's opens in South Africa or Sainsbury's does. But certainly we do have those conversations all the time, together with our partners in government and our partners in the rest of corporate South Africa, to say, let's sell South Africa as a ripe investment destination, and let's get international FDI coming into the country and building a more prosperous future for all of us.
Speaking of conversations that need to be had, I think you and I, Sam, need to sit down and have a conversation around the state of mergers and acquisitions. There's been a lot of deal activity that's been taking place throughout the year, but I think perhaps you and I can table that conversation for next week, because we have run out of time. I'd like to thank you, though, for the time and for your insights around this particular deal. Obviously, a step in the right direction for the JSE, but also for the South African investment landscape. We'll leave the conversation there, Sam. That's Sam Mokorosi, who is the head of origination and deals at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, on the latest announcement by the Supermarket Group listed in the UK that they'll be obtaining a secondary listing in South Africa, set to take place later this week.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next edition of Fix SA. I'm in conversation with Lawrence Rapp, who is a respected thought leader with over a decade of experience in the property sector. He leads the Vukile Property Fund. We're going to take a look at the biggest barriers to South Africa achieving its full economic potential, and also his views on specific leadership qualities that South Africa needs in both the public and private sectors to drive meaningful change.
Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And because it is Tuesday, we're going to wrap things up with a look at property this week. We're going to be taking a look at some interesting developments that have come out from the property space. There has been an amendment that has been signed through by the president around the deeds amendment bill that's been signed, aimed at improving the state of the deeds registry, the deeds office, and generally what that means for consumers. That's what we're going to take a look at now. I'm joined on the line by economist and contributor Dr. Roelof Botha to take a look at this. He's joining us from Better Bond to take a look at this and see if we can better understand this. Dr. Botha, lovely to catch up with you. Thanks for taking the time. Let's start by understanding, what are we amending here? What amendment did the president sign?
Well, it's the deeds registration regulations, and it has been received with a lot of gusto by the residential property market in particular, because there are more houses that are sold than obviously industrial properties in South Africa.
Mm. Dr. Botha, do we know what the specific changes are that have been kind of announced or that were put forward in the amendment?
Jimmy, I haven't actually looked at all the detail from a legal perspective. I'm a macroeconomist, as you probably know, but I have looked at the reaction from the legal profession and also from the property industry in general, especially estate agents, bond originators like Better Bond.
Mm.
And the overwhelming response is that, number one, this will highly likely lead to less fraud and corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, and this is very important from an economic perspective, it will fast track the process. And in economics, if you can fast track a process, just to give you one example, you've probably seen the results of the latest Afrimat Construction Index as well, which is quarter on quarter not so bad, but year on year still down. And one of the main reasons for that is the criminality at construction sites. We're talking 63 billion rand worth of projects, many of them infrastructure related, which just cannot get off the ground. And now there's this so-called Durban Declaration, which aims to halt the construction mafia. And the sooner this money can flow, the sooner you have job creation and the sooner you have a broadening of the tax base. So quite frankly, from a residential property market perspective, especially because of this ridiculously high interest rates we have in South Africa, this is such a positive development. It's almost like a Christmas present to the property market, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm. Dr. Botha, part of the adjustments, from what I can gather, is things around digitizing records. And obviously, that is an important thing in, one, dealing with the corruption side of it, but two, also just keeping a more accurate record of things. We've seen in the past there have been things around property disputes, you're not the registered owner of this, especially in the residential space. Do you think that digitizing these sorts of records then provides more transparency and accountability, I suppose, for those that are engaging in property transactions? Understanding, of course, that we also have a market in the residential space for international people coming to own property here.
Yes, I believe it will, without a shadow of doubt. You can never you can't get rid of the human element in any of these transactions, but by reducing the propensity for human errors and also human criminality in forging documents or falsifying documents, it will certainly assist. And it could also even play a role indirectly to get us back off the grey list, back on the blacklist. I don't know exactly what the alternative is, but if the international economic community in general and the banks also, they should be notified, that they should be kept in a loop about regulations which are aimed at fast-tracking decision-making in our economy and also streamlining the process. There are just too many regulations in South Africa. And I mean, I don't have to tell you what it's like in some of these municipalities with the slowness by which, for instance, building plans get passed. Inspectors that have to go and do inspections at building premises, and then they just don't pitch up and so on. So who knows? It does seem as if
since the government of national unity came into being in South Africa, just a host of indicators are improving. If you just look at the better bond index of home loan applications, that's up quarter on quarter by 11%. That is fantastic news.
Dr. Butter, when we look at the economic impact, you touched on this a little earlier to say that the property space and the construction space, there's different aspects to the infrastructure property and that world. But from a retail property perspective, I mean, it's always nice to be able to say that we do have an interest in these properties. But economically speaking, I mean, having properties that are attractive, having legislation and having structures in place that make South Africa an attractive investment destination, whether it's for local or international investors, doesn't really matter there. The attractiveness economically has that ripple effect on other areas, right? So even if we're looking at property in isolation, it'll have an effect on jobs, the jobs required to maintain those properties and those sorts of things. The economic impact can't be overlooked here, especially when we're looking at the property space.
I agree with you, Jimmy. It's hard to disagree with you, quite frankly. But if you can fast track economic decisions, it stands to reason that the money flows quicker, and the money of, you know, the bulk of the money ultimately goes to salaries and wages, value added. The bulk of value added is salaries and wages. And that money gets spent. It can only have a beneficial impact on our economy. If you look at the total value of, I just must slip this in, the total value of outstanding household credit in South Africa, we're talking about a figure of more than 2.1 trillion rand. Unfortunately, that figure is lower in real terms than it was 10 years ago, thanks to the restrictive monetary policy in this country ever since John Marcus retired. But 85% approximately of that figure of 2.1 trillion rand is mortgage bonds. Mm. Now, of course, mortgage bonds get used for other purposes than buying property. But still, it is hugely significant for property development in South Africa. And the construction sector will obviously benefit from this as well. Now, construction, not agriculture, that's number two. Construction is the single largest employment multiplier in this economy. And this is such a nice opportunity for government to focus on property development, to try to, as far as I'm concerned, change the composition of the Monetary Policy Committee to allow people from the private sector and from National Treasury and trade and industry to also participate. I'm talking about organizations and in the private sector that probably would like the economy to grow faster, and for that we require lower interest rates. So there's just such a lot happening right now. And by the way, this suggestion of mine, I'm going to take this forward.
Dr. Buerta, so you said something quite important around the development side of it and around infrastructure investments. We've heard the infrastructure drive that's been going on and the talk that's where we need to be focusing on. What would you say is holding things back? You touched on something around red tape. Do you think that in the context of infrastructure development is what's holding back us sparking real economic growth?
Yes, to a large extent. And then let's call a spade a spade. Mm. The municipalities are a vexed problem. Apart from the debt owed to Eskom, we're talking about the state of municipal decision-making in fixing, repairing infrastructure in South Africa. There have been appointments in the last decade under the state. We are still counting the cost of state capture. Under the guise of cadre deployment, you've had some appointments there of people who are not necessarily qualified to do that work. And Stellenbosch University has just come out with a brilliant paper on how to fix the municipalities. And it's a little bit academic, but I agree with more or less everything said in there. What we need now is to take that document further and have a plan of action and identify a particular municipality that's dysfunctional. And there's one not far from where I stay here in Brits. Just between Gauteng and Northwest. And it is such a fantastic area because they've got agriculture, mining, manufacturing, Firestone. They've got major packaging industries there, etc. And that town area could be, they've got a huge tax base, can be transformed if you just have the right skills and a plan of action, just like Mr. Schreiber did, Dr. Schreiber at Home Affairs. So there are signs that the new government of national unity, if this can also just be carried forward into local government, we can go places from a low base. We're probably looking at a possibility of 5% growth in 2026, not next year. We'll build the bridge towards that.
Just get implementation right. There's so much potential out there. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Dr. Botha. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Dr. Roelof Botha joining me to take a look at the latest amendment signed by the presidency, but also the catalyst that can be found in infrastructure development and property growth. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.